Chapter 24. Saturday, October 11th. The following Saturday was relatively peaceful. In fact, it's the most relaxing weekend my family has had since I took my new job. With Halloween a few weeks away, Paige insisted that we take the whole family out to the pumpkin patch. It was a chilly Saturday morning, so we were exhausted just bundling up the kids and getting them in the car. When we arrived at the nearby farm, Paige and I laughed uncontrollably at Parker, who looked like a giant, angry sausage stuffed into his blue parka. She couldn't resist taking pictures while Grant orbited us in excitement, taking pictures with his own camera. Afterward, we went to a local microbrewery, enjoying lunch on the patio in the warm afternoon sun.
"I'm so glad we could do this," Paige says. "It's really nice. You seem less stressed lately. I can really tell things are getting better."
She's right. It felt like we had turned a corner at work somehow. Just like how I wasn't wasting as much time fighting my ancient laptop, it seemed like my team was spending more and more of our time doing productive work and less firefighting. Although I know getting a new laptop has absolutely nothing to do with our organizational performance, getting rid of that old clunker was like getting rid of a 1,000-pound anchor that someone had tied around my neck while I was swimming across the ocean. We're still grappling with gradually melting the project freeze. I'm guessing that we'll probably be able to unfreeze 25% of all the projects, along with a bunch of other new projects designed to further elevate Brent. There were still so many uncertainties, but unlike before, our challenges feel within our ability to understand and conquer. Our goals finally seem achievable. I no longer feel like I am always on my heels, with more and more people piling on, trying to push me over. With the business agreeing, with the exception of Sarah, on what the priorities are, my job actually seems fair. It feels like we have the initiative and are attacking the problem, instead of the other way around. I like it. I look up to see Paige smiling back at me, and then yell out in panic as I see Parker knocking over her glass of beer. The rest of the afternoon passes too quickly, but it's one of the best days I've had all year. Later that evening, Paige is curled up with me on the couch. We're watching the Clint Eastwood movie Pale Rider. The kids have gone to sleep, and this is the first time we've actually watched a movie together in months. I laugh uncontrollably watching the main character, the preacher, played by Eastwood, methodically pick off the gang of 9 evil deputies. Paige looks at me with amused disapproval.
"What exactly is so funny about this?" she asks.
This makes me laugh harder. When another deputy gets shot in the background, I say, "Look at that. You know what's going to happen, but the marshal just stands there in the middle of the street, watching the carnage. Look at the way the wind rustles through his coat, and his gun isn't even drawn. I love it."
"I'll never understand you," Paige says, shaking her head with a smile.
Just then, my cell phone rings. I instinctively reach for it. Holy crap. It's John. No one has seen or heard from him since that audit meeting, over 2 weeks ago. We're pretty sure he hasn't been fired, but no one knows more than that. I've been meaning to check the local hospitals to make sure he's not convalescing alone somewhere. As much as I want to talk with him, I don't want to leave Paige and the movie. I look at the clock and see that there's probably only 15 more minutes until the end. Not wanting to miss the final gunfight, I mute the phone. I'll call him back when the movie is over. A couple of seconds later, my phone rings again. And again, I hit the mute button. For the third time, I mute the phone, but quickly send him a text message. "Great hearing from you. Can't talk right now. We'll call you in 20 minutes. Unbelievably, my phone buzzes again. So I turn the ringer off, putting my phone underneath some cushions on the couch. Paige asks, "Who keeps calling?" When I say, "John," she rolls her eyes, and we watch the remaining 10 minutes of the movie. "I can't believe I haven't seen that movie until tonight," I say, giving Paige a squeeze. "That was such a great idea, darling."
"It's been a great day," It's so nice having a normal life again, she says, returning my hug. And then with a smile, she gets up, taking the empty beer bottles with her.
I agree. I pick up my phone, my heart skipping a beat when I see 15 missed calls. Suddenly afraid that I may have missed something truly disastrous, I quickly look to see who called. Every call was from John. I call him immediately.
Billy, so good to hear your voice again. My friend. My dear, dear old friend, he slurs.
Good Lord, he's completely drunk.
Sorry I couldn't return your calls right away. I was out with Paige, I say, feeling guilty at my slight mistruth.
No problem. Look, I just wanted to see you one last time before I left.
Be leaving, he says.
Leaving? What do you mean, leaving? Where are you going? I say with alarm, wondering how long he's been drinking. Maybe I should have called back sooner.
I suddenly visualize him on the other end of the phone with an open bottle of sleeping pills in his hand, already half empty. I hear him laugh, maybe a bit hysterically.
Don't worry, Billy. I'm not going to kill myself. Haven't had enough to drink. Yet. Ha ha! I just wanted to see you before I left town tonight. Let me buy you one last drink.
Can't this wait until tomorrow? It's almost midnight, I say, slightly relieved. He tells me that he'll be long gone by tomorrow, and convinces me to join him at the Hammerhead Saloon downtown. When I pull into the parking lot, I immediately spot John's Volvo station wagon. Hitched behind his car is a U-Haul trailer, and there's a pile of empty beer cans right outside the driver's side door. I find him in a booth at the back of the crowded bar, and it's obvious he's been here all day. He doesn't seem to have bathed or changed his clothes since I last saw him. His hair is greasy and wildly askew, as if he just woke up. His face is covered in stubble, and there are food stains on his shirt. His keys and wallet have been tossed carelessly next to the salt and pepper shakers. John urgently waves over a waitress, taking a moment to rehearse his words, but still slurring as he says,
I'd like 2 double scotches, neat, for me and my friend here, and those yummy nachos. Please.
She looks over at me questioningly, obviously having already served him plenty. I nod, but I say quietly, Let's start with 2 cups of coffee, please. I'll take care of him. As I say it, I reach over and take his keys off the table. For a moment, she looks dubious, but gives me a small smile and walks away.
Dude, you look like shit, I say candidly.
Thanks, pal. So do you, he replies before bursting out laughing.
Nice.
Where the hell have you been? Everyone has been looking for you, I say.
I've been at home, he says, grabbing some popcorn from our table.
I've been mostly reading and watching TV. Whoa, there is some crazy shit on TV these days.
Crazy.
But then I started thinking, it's time for me to move on. So I spent most of today packing. I just wanted to ask you one little question before I left.
You mentioned that on the phone, I say, as the waitress arrives with 2 cups of coffee and the nachos.
John looks with confusion at the mugs on the table, so I say, Don't worry, our drinks are on the way.
When I get him to take a sip of coffee, he asks,
Just tell me straight. Is it really true that I haven't done anything of value for you? In all the 3 years that we've worked together, I've never, ever been helpful?
I take a deep breath, trying to decide what to tell him. A friend told me years ago, to tell the truth is an act of love. To withhold the truth is an act of hate, or worse, apathy. I had laughed at those words at the time, but over the years I've realized that having people give you honest feedback is a rare gift. Looking across at John, even though he looks like a completely broken man, I wonder whether the right thing to do is to just let him off easy and tell him what he wants to hear. Finally, I say, "Look, John, you're a good guy, and I know your heart is in the right place, but up until you helped hide us from the PCI auditors during the Phoenix meltdown, I would have said no. I know that's not what you want to hear, but I wanted to make sure that I wasn't feeding you a line of bullshit." Amazingly, John looks even more crestfallen than before. "Where's that goddamn scotch?" he yells out. Turning back to look at me, he says, "Are you serious? After 3 whole goddamn years of working together, you're telling me that I haven't helped you? Not even in the slightest bit?" "Well, for most of those years, I was in charge of the mid-range group, which you didn't get too involved with," I explain calmly. "We found our own security guidance on the web. When we did interact, you just tried to dump a bunch of work on me. Look, I care about security, and we always look for risks to our systems and data, but we're always up to our eyeballs in urgent work, trying to keep our heads above water. And in my new role, I'm just trying to help the company survive." John says, "But don't you see? That's what I'm trying to do too. I'm just trying to help you and the business survive." I reply, "I know. But in my world, I'm responsible for keeping all our services up and running and deploying new services like Phoenix. Security had to take a back seat. Trust me, I'm well aware of the risks of bad security, and I know it would be a career-ending move to have a large-scale security breach on my watch." I shrug my shoulders. "I'm making the best possible decisions given my knowledge of the risks. I just don't think that all the stuff you wanted me to do would have helped the business as much as all the other things on my plate." "Come on," I continue. "Does it bother you deep down that the business got through the SOX 404 audit without you? Does that make you question the importance and validity of your recommendations?" John just stares back at me. As if on cue, our waitress arrives with the 2 scotches. John picks his up and finishes it in 1 gulp. "Another round, please." When she looks at me, I shake my head and mouth the words, "Check, please, and call a cab." She nods and disappears. I take a sip of my scotch and look back at John. His head is now lolling backward, and he's muttering something. By now, he's completely unintelligible. I feel sorry for him. I take his wallet off the table. "Hey," he says. "Our waitress is tipping out and I've got to pay her, but I forgot my wallet at home," I say. He laughs at me, looking at me blearily. "No problem, old pal. I'll get this one. I always get them, don't I?" "Thanks," I say, and grab his driver's license. I wave over the waitress and point to his home address. Returning John's wallet, I pull out my own and pay. I help John up and pour him into the cab, making sure his wallet and keys are back in his pocket. Not wanting John to deal with the cabbie, I pay the cabbie too. Watching him leave, and then looking at his station wagon and U-Haul full of only a fraction of his worldly belongings, I just shake my head. I head back to my car, wondering when I'm going to see him next. The next day, I call John a couple of times on his cell phone, but he never answers. I finally leave him a voicemail telling him that I hoped he got home okay, where his car was, and to give me a ring if he needs anything. The rumor mill is abuzz. There's talk that he was hospitalized, arrested, abducted by aliens, or locked up in a mental institution. I'm not sure how these rumors were starting, as I didn't tell anyone about my late-night meeting with him, nor was I ever going to. I'm just finishing up putting Grant to bed on Monday night when I get a text message from John. I quickly read it. "Thanks for the lift home the other day. Been thinking. I told Dick that you'll be joining our 8 a.m. meeting tomorrow. Should be interesting." What meeting with Dick? I stare at my phone. On the one hand, John is alive and seems able to work. That's good. On the other hand, John is now talking about meeting with Dick, the second most powerful executive in the company, tomorrow morning, potentially in some mentally unbalanced state, and has already broadcast that I'm his co-conspirator. That's not so good. I quickly tap out my reply to him. Good hearing from you. Hope you're doing okay. What is Dick meeting about? May not be able to make it. He responds immediately. I've been arrogant. Realized, yes, that I don't actually know much about Dick. Must change that. Together. Worried that John may be completely off his rocker, I immediately call him. He answers on the first ring, sounding oddly cheery. I hear him say, Good evening, Bill. Thanks again for Saturday night. What's up? What exactly are you up to, John? I say. What's this meeting tomorrow with Dick about? And why are you dragging me into it? He replies, I spent most of yesterday in bed, since I could barely get myself to the bathroom and back. My head felt like it was a lemon smashed by a brick. What drinks were you buying me that night? He doesn't wait for me to answer before continuing. I kept thinking about our last conversation at the bar. I realized that if I haven't done anything useful for you, who I should have the most in common with, then it stands to reason that I haven't been useful to almost everyone else, who I have nothing in common with. That's got to change, he says adamantly. I bite my tongue, wanting to hear John out before I recommend that he cancel tomorrow's meeting. He continues, I kept thinking about what Eric said, that he'd be ready to talk to me when Dick says he wants me around. I don't think a quick 30-minute getting-to-know-you meeting is going to get you there, I say, seriously skeptical. He responds with complete calm. Wouldn't you agree, like so many things in life, that we must always start by at least gaining an understanding of the person we're dealing with? What could go wrong? I just want to learn more about his job. In my head, I immediately envision John asking or saying something stupid, completely pissing Dick off, and Dick firing him on the spot, and then firing me too just to eliminate the contagion. Yet I find myself saying, Okay, I'll be there. Chapter 25. Tuesday, October 14th. The next morning at 7:50 a.m., I'm heading toward Dick's office. As I round the corner, I see John already chatting amiably with Dick's assistant. My jaw drops. John's physical appearance has completely changed. He's obviously showered and cleaned up. He's also shaved his head and appears to have lost 15 pounds. He's wearing what I can only describe as a European-styled shirt and a vest. Unlike the slightly baggy shirts he usually wears, the pink shirt he's wearing fits tightly on him. Combined with the vest, he looks like a fashion model, London clubber, Las Vegas card dealer. With the shaved head, his calm, friendly smile, and perfect posture, he looks like some sort of enlightened monk. Most significantly, I notice that his three-ring binder is nowhere to be seen. Instead, he's carrying only a pristine black-and-white lab notebook and a pen. Good morning, Bill, John says with beatific calm. Hi, I finally say. You're looking better than the last time I saw you. He just smiles and then says something quietly to Dick's assistant that makes her clap her hands over her mouth and laugh loudly. She then gets up, walks over to Dick's door, and gestures both of us to follow her, saying, Let's see if we can start your meeting a little early. It'll give you more time with him. I'm walking into Dick's office, trailing behind John.
Nice haircut, Dick says to John with a smile, pointing at his own bald head.
Then in a businesslike tone, he says,
So, what can I do for you? I have a commitment at 8:30, so let's not waste time.
John opens his notebook to the first page, which is completely blank. Thanks for taking the time to meet with us on such short notice. I promise you that we won't waste your time. And to make sure I don't have any incorrect or preconceived notions, could you start by telling us what exactly you do here at Parts Unlimited? What is your exact role? My eyes widen in horror at John's question. This is what gets asked on Bring Your Kid to Work Day, but not by company executives. I quickly look over to gauge Dick's reaction. He looks surprised for a moment, but then blandly replies, "Interesting question." He pauses briefly and then seems to just play along.
"I started here at Parts Unlimited 15 years ago as CFO, which back then was defined in a pretty traditional way. I was primarily responsible for managing the financial risks of the organization and leading the financial planning and operations processes. Even back then, we had a huge number of regulatory compliance issues, which I also owned. Shortly after Steve became CEO, he told me that we needed a senior executive to own planning and operations across the entire organization, and then gave those responsibilities to me. To help ensure that the company achieves our goals, I set up the objectives and measurements program for the entire management team. I wanted to keep all our managers accountable, ensure that they have the skills necessary to succeed, and help make sure that complex initiatives always have the right stakeholders involved, and so forth." John looks up from furiously taking notes on the first page in his new notebook.
"I've heard many people call you the de facto COO around here, and that you're basically Steve's right-hand man." Dick considers his comments for a moment before saying,
"My official title doesn't have operations anywhere in it, but it's the part of my job that I love most. When a company is as big as we are, with so many business processes, so many managers and workers, almost everything is complex. As smart as Steve is, even he needs help making sure the company's strategy and goals are realistic, and making an objective assessment of what we're really capable of." With a very small smile, he adds, "Want to hear something funny? People say that I'm more approachable than Steve. Steve's incredibly charismatic, and let's face it, I'm an asshole. But when people have concerns, they don't want to have their minds changed. They want someone to listen to them and help make sure Steve gets the message." I find myself leaning forward. I'm surprised to hear Dick giving John, and therefore me, such candid and informative answers.
"What differentiates a good day from a bad day for you?" John continues. Momentarily taken aback, Dick laughs loudly.
"I'll tell you what a good day feels like. It feels like the end of the year when we're beating the pants off the competition. When we haven't closed the books yet, but everyone knows that it's going to be a monster quarter. All the salespeople would have hit quota, and the ones on top would have hit their accelerators. A good day feels like my staff panicking about the size of the commission checks we're going to be writing them. I'm not worried, because those big commission checks would mean the company is making money," he says, smiling even more broadly. "Steve would be excited to announce to Wall Street and the analysts how well the company is performing. All made possible because we had a winning strategy, and also because we had the right plan and the ability to operate and execute. It means we got all the parts of this organization to click as a team and win. That's a fun day for me. We can plan and plan until the cows come home, but until we execute and achieve the goals, it's academic," he says. Then his smile disappears. "Of course, we haven't had a day like that in over 4 years. A bad day is like the one we had 2 weeks ago," he says, now looking frustrated and even angry. "We can't close the quarter because of some IT failure. We can't seem to execute on our most critical project to close the gap with the competition. We keep losing customers. The auditors are making noises about some restatement project, and the board of directors is debating whether to fire all of us because we're such screw-ups.
Dick shakes his head with a wan, tired smile.
In those moments, you wonder whether the problem is the economy, our strategy, our management team, you IT guys, or, quite frankly, maybe the entire problem is me. Those are the days I just want to retire.
John looks down at his notes and then asks, What are your goals, objectives, and measurements for this year?
Dick gets up from the sitting area to walk to his desk, saying, Here, I'll show you.
He picks up a thin, black three-ring binder that was open on his desk, sits back down across from us, and shows us the open binder.
Here are two slides I look at every day.
CFO goals, health of company, revenue, market share, average order size, profitability, return on assets, health of finance, order to cash cycle, accounts receivable, accurate and timely financial reporting, borrowing costs.
These are the company goals and the objectives I've set for finance, he explains. I've learned that while the finance goals are important, they're not the most important. Finance can hit all our objectives, and the company can still fail. After all, the best accounts receivables team on the planet can't save us if we're in the wrong market with the wrong product strategy with an R&D team that can't deliver.
Startled, I realize he's talking about Eric's first way. He's talking about systems thinking, always confirming that the entire organization achieves its goal, not just one part of it. As I'm pondering this, Dick then points to the second slide, saying,
So that's what's on the second slide, which shows what I believe are the more important company goals. I look at this slide every day.
Are we competitive? Understanding customer needs and wants. Do we know what to build? Product portfolio. Do we have the right products? R&D effectiveness. Can we build it effectively? Time to market. Can we ship it soon enough to matter? Sales pipeline. Can we convert products to interested prospects? Are we effective? Customer on-time delivery. Are customers getting what we promised them? Customer retention. Are we gaining or losing customers? Sales forecast accuracy. Can we factor this into sales planning process? John and I lean forward to study the slide. Usually, company managers like me only see our departmental objectives. This slide shows the bigger picture. As I'm thinking, John points at the slide and asks,
Which of these measurements are most at risk?
Dick laughs humorlessly.
All of them. From a product portfolio perspective, the competition is killing us and taking market share away from us each day. We're $20 million and years into Project Phoenix, and we're still not competitive in the market yet. On the retailing and manufacturing side of the business, customer satisfaction is dropping, and we're losing customers, despite sales' promise that we can win them back somehow.
John underlines some of his notes.
Can we have a copy of this? Bill and I would like to study this further and make sure our teams understand this, so we can ensure that everything we do helps advance these goals.
Dick thinks for a moment.
Sure. Can't hurt, I suppose. I'll have my assistant give you both a copy on your way out.
One more thing, John says. For each of these initiatives and measurements, who are the managers held responsible and accountable?
Dick looks at John appraisingly, as do I. I've never seen this side of John before either.
Dick says, My assistant will get you the spreadsheet with those names on it as well.
John thanks him and then looks at his watch.
We're almost out of time. This has been really terrific. Thank you for taking the time to tell us about your daily life. Is there anything that either of us can do for you?
Sure, he replies. Stay focused and get Phoenix working. Without it, we are stuck in the mud.
I frown. I look at the second slide again. I feel like Phoenix is not what Dick should be asking me to focus on. Unable to articulate why, I merely say,
Yes, sir.
We'll surely have some good news to share by the end of the month. I'm not entirely sure what that good news will be, but I've learned that when dealing with senior officers, there's a time and a place for telling bad news. This is neither of them. Good, he says, giving us a tight-lipped smile. We exchange parting pleasantries and head out of his office. As the elevator doors open, John says to me,
You know, I think there's something very similar about us dodging the SOX 404 audit bullet and what's on Dick's second slide, he says. I can't quite put my finger on it, but I think there's something here that we need to understand better.
You're right, I say. I don't think Dick realizes how much his measurements depend on IT. He asked me about Phoenix, but he should have asked me about all the objectives. We both step into the elevator. I continue. Are you available later today to meet? Let's see if we can connect all these dots. I suspect that we're sitting on the missing link that might explain both why the company keeps missing its goals, as well as why IT keeps being undervalued. Absolutely, he says excitedly. I can barely contain my sense of excitement. John's crazy meeting with Dick seems to have revealed something genuinely important. I believe with utter certainty that whatever we're trying to figure out is critical to the first way. He talked about the need to understand the true business context that IT resides in. I'm pretty sure no one has linked Dick's top measurements to the prerequisite IT objectives. No wonder Dick just has a vague sense that IT is screwing up. It's a dull, throbbing ache that he can't localize. Our next step is obvious. We must make those pains very specific and visible to convince Dick that IT is capable of not just screwing up less often, but helping all of the business win. This is too important and urgent to struggle blindly in the dark, and I need to call Eric for advice. Standing in the lobby of Building 2, I speed dial him.
Yeah? I hear him answer.
I say, Good morning, Eric. I've just had a remarkable meeting with Dick. Do you have some time to help me think through this? When he grunts, Yes, I describe to him the meeting and how it came about and my certainty that it has uncovered something critical.
Well, good for Jimmy. Or maybe I should call him John.
He finally got his head far enough out of his ass to begin to see, I hear Eric say as he laughs, not unkindly.
As part of the first way, you must gain a true understanding of the business system that IT operates in. W. Edwards Deming called this appreciation for the system. When it comes to IT, you face two difficulties. On the one hand, in Dick's second slide, you now see that there are organizational commitments that IT is responsible for helping uphold and protect that no one has verbalized precisely yet. On the other hand, John has discovered that some IT controls he holds near and dear aren't needed, because other parts of the organization are adequately mitigating those risks. This is all about scoping what really matters inside of IT. And like when Mr. Sphere told everyone in Flatland, you must leave the realm of IT to discover where the business relies on IT to achieve its goals. I hear him continue. Your mission is twofold. You must find where you've underscoped IT, such as all those SOX 404 IT controls that weren't necessary to detect material errors in the financial statements. You may think that we're mixing apples and oranges, but I assure you that we are not, he continues. Some of the wisest auditors say that there are only three internal control objectives: to gain assurance for reliability of financial reporting, compliance with laws and regulations, and efficiency and effectiveness of operations. That's it. What you and John are talking about are just different sides of what is called the COSO cube. I force myself to keep listening, furiously taking notes so I can Google these terms later. I hear him continue. Here's what you and John need to do. Go talk to the business process owners for the objectives on Dick's second slide. Find out what their exact roles are,
what business processes underpin their goals, and then get from them the top list of things that jeopardize those goals. You must understand the value chains required to achieve each of Dick's goals, including the ones that aren't so visible, like those in IT. For instance, if you were a cross-country freight shipping company that delivers packages using a fleet of 100 trucks, one of your corporate goals would be customer satisfaction and on-time delivery, I hear him continue. Everybody knows that one factor jeopardizing on-time delivery is vehicle breakdowns. A key causal factor for vehicle breakdowns is failure to change the oil. So, to mitigate that risk, you'd create an SLA for vehicle operations to change the oil every 5,000 miles. Obviously enjoying himself, he keeps explaining, "Our organizational key performance indicator, KPI, is on-time delivery. So to achieve it, you would create a new forward-looking KPI of, say, the percentage of vehicles that have had their required oil changes performed. After all, if only 50% of our vehicles are complying with the required maintenance policies, it's a good bet that in the near future, our on-time delivery KPIs are going to take a dive when trucks start getting stranded on the side of the road, along with all the packages they're carrying. People think that just because IT doesn't use motor oil and carry physical packages, that it doesn't need preventative maintenance," Eric says, chuckling to himself. "That somehow, because the work and the cargo that IT carries are invisible, you just need to sprinkle more magic dust on the computers to get them running again. Metaphors like oil changes help people make that connection. Preventative oil changes and vehicle maintenance policies are like preventative vendor patches and change management policies. By showing how IT risks jeopardize business performance measures, you can start making better business decisions." "Okay, one last thing before I go," he says. "Make sure John fulfills his mission. He must talk with the finance side of the SOX 404 audit team. He must learn exactly how the business managed to dodge the last audit bullet and what the actual control environment looks like and where Reliance is really placed. And he must then explain it to you. You'll be ready for your meeting with Dick when you've built out the value chains, linking his objectives to how IT jeopardizes it, assembling concrete examples of how IT issues have jeopardized those goals in the past. Make sure you're prepared." And with that, he says, "In fact, feel free to invite me to that meeting. I want to see Dick's face when you present what you learn." And he hangs up the phone. Chapter 26. Friday, October 17th. When Patty enters the conference room, she gasps loudly when she sees John's transformed appearance.
"Oh my God, John! You look fantastic!"
Surprisingly, when Wes arrives, he doesn't seem to notice anything different. When everyone is here, I quickly share what I had learned from Eric. We decide that Patty and I will start the business process owner interviews for understanding customer needs and wants, product portfolio, time to market, and sales pipeline, while John will research the business SOX 404 control environment, as directed by Eric. It's Friday, and we're scheduled to interview Ron Johnson, the VP of Manufacturing Sales. I worked with him years ago as part of the acquisition integration project, and I'm surprised he's in town. He's usually out and about, traveling the world, helping to negotiate deals and save troubled accounts. He has a well-deserved reputation as one of the most fun people in the company to travel with. The size of his expense reports proves it. Patty and I are sitting in front of his desk in Building 2. As we listen to him bellow at his colleagues on a conference call, I look at the many pictures of him on the wall, on golf courses, with his top salespeople in exotic locales from decades of president's clubs, and shaking hands with customers. In the corner is a fake potted tree, completely covered with hundreds of conference badges and lanyards. This is definitely the office of someone who loves being in front of people. He's a large, gregarious guy with an even larger laugh. Over many scotches with him one evening in Chicago, I was surprised to learn that much of his demeanor is a carefully crafted persona. While he's outwardly very loud and outspoken, he's actually an introvert by nature, very analytic and passionate about sales discipline. Hearing him chastise yet another person on the phone, I think about how odd it is that even a discipline like sales, known for its chaotic and unpredictable nature, is more predictable than IT. There's at least a predictable funnel that comes from marketing campaigns, generating prospects, leads, qualified leads, and sales opportunities that leads to a sales pipeline. One salesperson missing their number rarely jeopardizes the entire department. On the other hand, any of my engineers can get me fired by making a seemingly small, harmless change that results in a crippling, enterprise-wide outage. Ron slams down the phone. Sorry, guys. Despite all the training I do, sometimes my team behaves like a bunch of wild animals, he says, still exasperated. He rips the stapled document he's holding in two and then tosses it into his trash can. Aw, man, Ron, I can't help but say. Your recycling bin is right next to you. I'll be dead long before the landfills are full, he says with a large laugh. He may be dead soon, but my kids won't be. As I explain to him why we're here, I reach under the desk to grab the papers from the wastebasket, putting them in the recycling bin. You're listed as the owner of the sales pipeline and sales forecast accuracy measures on Dick's spreadsheet. What can you tell me about the challenges of hitting those numbers? Look, I don't know much about IT. Someone on my staff might be better for you to talk to, he responds. Don't worry, I'm not asking about anything IT-related. Let's just talk about your measures, I assure him. Okay, it's your nickel, he says. If you want to talk about sales forecast accuracy, you first need to know why it's so inaccurate. It starts when Steve and Dick hand me a crazy revenue target, leaving me to figure out how to deliver on it. For years, I've had to assign away too much quota capacity to my team, so of course we keep missing our numbers. I tell Steve and Dick this year after year, but they don't listen, probably because they're having some arbitrary revenue target jammed down their throats by the board. It's a crappy way to run a company. It demoralizes my team, and my top performers are quitting in droves. Of course, we'll replace them, but it takes at least a year for replacements to perform at full quota capacity. Even in this lousy economy, it takes too long to find qualified salespeople. You know what chips my hide? He continues. Sarah promised that acquiring the retail stores would accelerate our sales. And has it happened? Hell no! We're completely screwing up the execution. This morning, a district manager was screaming that they need truckloads of our new fuel injector kits because all his stores are completely stocked out. We're losing the easiest sales we can make. Our customers want to buy, but they're walking out empty-handed, probably buying something crappier from one of our competitors, Ron says angrily. We are clueless about what our customers want. We have too much product that will never sell, and never enough of the ones that do. His words sounding familiar, I look down at Dick's slide again. You're saying that sales forecast accuracy is being jeopardized by our poor grasp of understanding our customer needs and wants, and that if we know what products were out of stock in the stores, we could increase sales? You got it, he says. With the traffic we get in the stores, that's the fastest and easiest way to increase revenue. It's a lot easier than dealing with the fickle whims of our large automotive buyers, that's for sure. I make a note to myself to find out how stockout data are generated, and I see Patty furiously taking notes as well. I ask Ron about the sales pipeline process and its challenges, and I get an earful. He tells us at length how difficult it is for his managers to get the reports they need out of our customer relationship management system, CRM, and the endless battle to make sure his entire sales force uses it in their daily work. But the floodgates really open when I ask him what a bad day for him looks like. A bad day? He repeats, staring at me disapprovingly. Why, Bill, It's positively catastrophic when the MRP and phone systems that you manage go down like they did a few weeks ago. For just the MRP outage, we had customers screaming about delayed orders, and two of them canceled $250,000 of orders outright. We're scrambling to keep some of our best customers from putting $1.5 million of contracts up for rebid. He leans across his desk. And when the phones went down in the last few days of the quarter and customers couldn't give us orders or make last-minute changes, that's delayed another $1.5 million of orders. And 10 customers are reevaluating their contracts, putting another $5 million of contracts at risk. You're making my job much, much harder, pal, he says. A lot of my salespeople miss their quota by the tiniest fractions due to things totally outside their control. To keep morale up, I'm demanding Steve give quota credit for any order that was delayed because of our screw-ups. I grimace. Steve's going to love that idea as much as he loved Sarah giving away vouchers to disgruntled Phoenix customers. I'm really sorry that happened on my watch. There's no excuse for it, I say sincerely. I tell him what happened with the vendor making the unauthorized change to the phone switch and the steps we're taking to ensure that it doesn't happen again. I explain. We have change control policies, but as you know, training and trust only go so far. At some point, we need monitoring to enforce those policies. The trouble is, we need to expand the licensing beyond what information security has deployed, and emergency capital is hard to get these days, especially for IT operations. Ron turns bright red.
Why? What are they saving it for?
Probably another harebrained acquisition that Sarah is dreaming up. He laughs humorlessly.
How much more money are we talking about?
When I tell him, he looks disgusted.
We spend more money watering the lawns at the manufacturing plants every week. Dick is going to hear from me about this. If he's not willing to spend money, we may lose orders, even if your project is just insurance so we can collect on all the hard work my sales team does. It's a no-brainer.
We sure think so. Thanks for the support, I say. We're about out of time. Are there any other challenges or impediments that we can help with? He looks at his watch for a moment.
No, just keep those vendors from crashing our phone systems again, you hear?
Patty looks invigorated as she flips through all her notes by the elevator banks. She says,
Ron mentioned how critical the phones and the MRP systems are, but I'm sure there's more, like the inventory management systems. I'll work on creating the complete list of applications and infrastructure that support Ron. If any of them are fragile, we'll need to get them added to our replacement list. This is a great opportunity to be proactive.
You read my mind, I say, smiling. That preventative work supports the most important objectives of the company. How do we know? We started from the measures that Dick cares about most. I'm pleased. Now I'm really looking forward to our next interview, which is with Maggie Lee, who sponsored Phoenix. Patty and I meet with Maggie on the following Monday. Over the weekend, Sarah emailed me, demanding to know the agenda for the meeting, threatening to cancel it. When I start copying Dick and Steve on my replies, she relents, but warns me not to meddle with her department. I'm not worried. Both Patty and I work with Maggie regularly. She's the business sponsor of over half the IT projects. Among other things, Maggie is responsible for making sure that the company has the best possible assortment of merchandise in each of our stores, and she owns the category and pricing roadmaps. In describing her responsibilities, she summarizes,
Ultimately, the way I measure our understanding of customer needs and wants is whether customers would recommend us to their friends. Any way you cut it, our metrics aren't very good.
When I ask why, she sighs.
Most of the time, we're flying blind. Ideally, our sales data would tell us what customers want. You'd think that with all the data in our order entry and inventory management systems, we could do this. But we can't, because the data are almost always wrong.
Patty glances my way meaningfully as Maggie continues.
Our data quality is so bad that we can't rely on it to do any sort of forecasting. The best data that we have right now comes from interviewing our store managers every 2 months and the customer focus groups we do twice a year. You can't run a billion-dollar business this way and expect to succeed. At my last job, we received sales and stockout reports every day, she continues. Here, we get them once a month from finance, but they're full of errors. What do you expect? They're done by a bunch of college interns, copying and pasting numbers between a million spreadsheets.
If you could wave a magic wand, what would you do instead? I ask.
How big of a magic wand? She asks.
It can do anything you want, I reply, smiling.
That's a big magic wand, she says, laughing. I want accurate and timely order information from our stores and online channels. I want to press a button and get it, instead of running it through the circus we've created. I'd use that data to create marketing campaigns that continually do A/B testing of offers, finding the ones that our customers jump at. When we find out what works, we'd replicate it across our entire customer list. By doing this, we'd be creating a huge and predictable sales funnel for Ron. I'd use that information to drive our production schedule, so we can manage our supply and demand curves. We'd keep the right products on the right store shelves and keep them stocked. Our revenue per customer would go through the roof. Our average order sizes would go up. We'd finally increase our market share and start beating the competition again. As she's telling us this, she looks animated and excited. Then her exuberance disappears. Sounding defeated, she says, "But we're stuck with the systems we have, unfortunately."
Wait a second. I thought Phoenix was supposed to fix all this, I ask. She snorts in disgust.
All we've gotten from Phoenix is a bunch of promises. It was supposed to do a lot of this reporting, but there's so much political pressure to ship something, they keep dropping features. And guess which feature they're delaying until sometime next year?
She rolls her eyes in disbelief. Reporting, I guess, fearing the worst. When Maggie nods, I try to stay upbeat. For now, let's assume that the magic wand worked. We now have great data coming out of the stores. You're keeping the right products in the stores, and the campaigns you're dreaming up are succeeding beyond your wildest dreams. What then?
Life gets exciting, that's what, she says, her eyes lighting up. Last year, we shipped a custom fuel injection system for a new upcoming sports car. We had just 6 months to get this to market, from the drawing board to the shelves. We nailed it. The designers, R&D folks, and marketing all kicked ass. We had the right product, right place, right brand, right price, and right quality. It was one of the best-selling products of the year. We took a risk and won big, she says. If we had better visibility into our retail operations, with our amazing R&D and manufacturing capabilities, we could make 50 of those bets per year. I'd bet 4 of those would be runaway hits. We'd not only be profitable, we'd be insanely profitable.
Patty interjects.
What's an acceptable time to market for your products?
She responds quickly.
These days? Products need to ship in 6 months, 9 months tops. Otherwise, some Chinese company will steal our idea, have them on our competitors' store shelves, and take the majority of the market. In these competitive times, the name of the game is quick time to market and to fail fast. We just can't have multi-year product development timelines, waiting until the end to figure out whether we have a winner or loser on our hands. We need short and quick cycle times to continually integrate feedback from the marketplace. But that's just half the picture, she continues. The longer the product development cycle, the longer the company capital is locked up and not giving us a return. Dick expects that on average our R&D investments return more than 10%. That's the internal hurdle rate. If we don't beat that hurdle rate, the company capital would have been better spent being invested in the stock market or gambled on racehorses. When R&D capital is locked up as WIP for more than a year, not returning cash back to the business, it becomes almost impossible to pay back the business, she continues.
Holy crap.
Maggie is starting to sound eerily like Eric, too.
The need to continually reduce cycle times is part of the first way. The need for amplification of feedback loops, ideally from the customer, is part of the second way. But 9 months to return cash back to the company tops? We've been at Phoenix for nearly 3 years, and it still hasn't created the desired business value. I have a terrible feeling that we may be going about Phoenix entirely the wrong way. Looking at my watch, I see that we're almost out of time. Putting the thoughts of Phoenix aside, I ask Maggie about other ways that IT is impeding the achievement of her goals. Her expression darkens.
Well, there is one more thing.
Maggie then describes the intense competition for IT project resources.
Our planning horizon is 6 to 12 months.
How does anyone know what projects they should be working on 3 years from now?
She says angrily, suddenly reminding me of Ron. Nothing unifies people better than complaining about IT. I completely understand your frustration, I say stoically. You have any ideas on how to fix it? She shares a bunch of ideas about hiring more IT people, dedicating IT people to her group, putting more scrutiny on the projects that are clogging the IT project queue, and so forth. Most of the ideas aren't new, and I merely raise my eyebrows at the notion of a larger IT budget. Steve and Dick will never go for that.
Incredible! Patty exclaims as we leave Maggie's office. I can't believe how frustrated Maggie and Ron are. Can you believe that unreliable data in the order entry and inventory management systems came up again? And I can't believe that Phoenix, as it's currently designed, won't actually fix the data quality problems.
I nod and say decisively, get a meeting together with John and Wes. We'll show them what we've learned so far. Invite Chris as well. This goes beyond just IT operations. This may change how we prioritize and develop our applications, too. As she leaves, I look at my Phoenix calculations again. We've spent over $20 million on Phoenix over 3 years. With all that WIP and capital locked inside the project, it will likely never clear the 10% internal hurdle rate. In other words, Phoenix should not have been approved.
Chapter 27. Tuesday, October 21st. I'm in a conference room with Patty, Wes, Chris, and John to share the progress Patty and I have made. I begin by stating, we interviewed Ron and Maggie, the business process owners on Dick's company measurement slide. I've spent some time thinking about what we've learned. I dig out my notes and walk to the whiteboard, writing out, Parts Unlimited desired business outcomes, increase revenue, increase market share, increase average order size, restore profitability, increase return on assets. Then I draw a table. Pointing at the whiteboard, I say, the first column names the business capabilities and processes needed to achieve Dick's desired outcomes. The second column lists the IT systems that those business processes rely upon. The third column lists what can go wrong with either the IT systems or data. And in the fourth column, we'll write down the countermeasures to prevent those bad things from happening, or at a minimum, detect and respond. For the next half hour, I walk them through the table and all the grievances. Apparently, for the things that Dick cares about most, IT matters, I say, deadpan. Wes says,
Come on, I'm not the smartest guy in the room by any stretch. But if we're so important, why are they trying to outsource all of us? Face it, we've been moved from one foster home to another for decades.
None of us have a good answer.
You know, I really like Bill's third column, Business Risk Due to IT, John says. By describing what could go wrong in IT that prevents the business outcome from being achieved, we're helping the business process owners get their bonuses. This should be very persuasive. We may even be thanked by the business for doing all this work, which would be a refreshing change.
I agree. Nice job, Bill, Chris says finally. But what's the solution?
I say, anyone have any ideas? Surprisingly, John speaks up first.
Seems pretty obvious to me.
We need to come with the controls to mitigate the risks in your third column. We then show this table to Ron and Maggie and make sure they believe that our countermeasures help them achieve their objectives. If they buy it, we work with them to integrate IT into their performance measures.
That example Eric gave you is perfect. They integrated compliance with vehicle maintenance procedures as a leading indicator for on-time delivery and customer retention. We need to do the same.
We roll up our sleeves and get to work. For the phone and MRP systems, we quickly establish that the predictive measures include compliance with the change management process, supervision and review of production changes, completion of scheduled maintenance, and elimination of all known single points of failure. When we tackle customer needs and wants, we get stuck. It's John who gets us rolling again.
Here, the objective isn't system availability, it's the integrity of data, which, incidentally, form two of the three legs of the confidentiality, integrity, and availability triangle, or CIA. He asks Chris,
"So what's causing the data integrity issues?"
Chris snorts in disgust.
"Phoenix fixes a bunch of them, but we still have issues. Most of them are caused upstream, because the marketing people keep putting in malformed inventory SKUs. Marketing needs to keep their crap together, too."
So, for marketing needs and wants, our proposed measurements include ability for Phoenix to support weekly and eventually daily reporting, percentage of valid SKUs created by marketing, and so forth. By the end of the day, we've generated a slide deck that Patty and I will take back to Ron and Maggie, which we'll then present to Dick.
"Now that, my friends, is a solid proposal," Wes says proudly.
With a loud laugh, he says,
"Even a monkey could follow the dots we just connected."
Over the next day, Patty and I get great feedback from Ron and Maggie, and they commit to supporting our proposal with Dick. When Ron learns that we still haven't been granted budget for our monitoring project, he calls up Dick right in front of us, leaving him a heated voicemail, demanding to know why he's dragging his feet. With all this enthusiastic support, I figure our Thursday meeting with Dick will be a slam dunk.
"All you've told me is that you're completely asleep at the wheel," Dick says sternly, obviously unimpressed by what I've presented.
Suddenly, I'm reminded of how Steve didn't even look at the spreadsheets I had prepared for him when I asked him to prioritize Phoenix and the audit finding work. But Dick isn't being dismissive. He's actually angry.
"You're telling me something a nutless monkey could have figured out. You didn't know these measurements were important? At every town hall meeting, Steve repeats them over and over. It's in our company newsletters. It's what Sarah talks about in every one of her strategy briefings. How could you all miss something so important?"
I see Chris and Patty fidget on either side of me as we sit across the table from Dick. Eric is standing by the window, leaning against the wall. I have a flashback to when I was a Marine sergeant, holding the flag on parade. Out of nowhere, a colonel appeared, growling at me in front of my entire unit.
"That's an out-of-regulation watch band, Sergeant Palmer."
I could have died on the spot from embarrassment, because I knew I had screwed up. But today, I'm certain I understand the mission, and for the company to succeed, I need Dick to understand what I've just learned. But how? Eric clears his throat and says to Dick,
"I agree, a nutless monkey should have figured this out.
So, Dick, explain why on that little measurement spreadsheet of yours, you list four levels of management for each of your measurements, but nowhere are there any IT managers listed. Why?"
Not waiting for Dick to respond, he continues,
"Every week, IT people get dragged into fire drills at the last minute by managers trying to achieve those measurements, just like Brent was pulled in to help launch Sarah's latest sales promotion."
Eric pauses and says,
"Quite frankly, I think you're just as much of a nutless monkey as Bill."
Dick grunts, but doesn't seem perturbed. He finally says,
Maybe so, Eric. You know, 5 years ago, we used to have our CIO attend our quarterly business reviews, but he never opened his mouth except to tell us that everything we proposed was impossible. After a year of that, Steve stopped inviting him. Dick turns back to me. Bill, you're telling me that everyone could do everything right in the business, but because of these IT issues, we would all still miss these objectives? Yes, sir, I say. The operational risks posed by IT need to be managed just like any other business risk. In other words, they're not IT risks, they're business risks. Again, Dick grunts. He slumps in his chair, rubbing his eyes. Shit. How the hell are we supposed to write an IT outsourcing contract if we don't even know what the business needs? He says, slamming his hand on the table. He then asks, Well, what's your proposal? You've got one, I presume? I sit up and begin the pitch that I've rehearsed so many times with the team. I'd like 3 weeks with each of the business process owners on that spreadsheet. We need to get the business risks posed by IT better defined and agreed upon, and then propose to you a way to integrate those risks into leading indicators of performance. Our goal is not just to improve business performance, but to get earlier indicators of whether we're going to achieve them or not, so we can take appropriate action. Furthermore, I continue, I'd like to schedule a single topic meeting with you and Chris about Phoenix, then explaining my concerns how Phoenix as defined should not even have been approved. I continue. We're going way too slowly, with too much whip and too many features in flight. We need to make our releases smaller and shorter and deliver cashback faster, so we can beat the internal hurdle rate. Chris and I have some ideas, but it will look very different than our current plan of record. He remains silent. Then, decisively, he declares, Yes on both of your proposals. I'll assign Anne to help. You need the best talent in the company. Out of the corner of my eye, I see Chris and Patty smile. Thank you, sir. We'll make it so, I say, standing up and pushing everyone out of the room before Dick changes his mind. As we walk out of his office, Eric claps his hand on my shoulder. Not bad, kid. Congratulations on being well on your way to mastering the first way. Now, help John get there, because you're going to have your hands full tackling the second way. Confused, I ask, Why? What's going to happen? You'll find out soon enough, Eric says with a chuckle. On Friday, John convenes a meeting with Wes, Patty, and me, promising some fantastic news. He says effusively, You guys did fantastic work linking IT to Dick's operational objectives. I finally learned how we dodged the audit bullet, and I'm pretty sure we can do something equally fantastic to reduce our audit and compliance workload. Doing less audit work? Wes says, looking up, putting his phone down. I'm all ears. He has my attention, too. If there were some way to get audit off our backs without another baton death march, it would be nothing short of a miracle. He turns toward Wes and Patty. I needed to figure out how we escaped all the findings from the internal and external auditors. At first, I thought it was just the audit partner bending over backward to retain us as a client, but that wasn't it at all. I got in front of everyone from the Parts Unlimited team who was at that meeting, trying to figure out who had the magic bullet. To my surprise, it wasn't Dick or our corporate counsel. 10 meetings later, I finally found Faye, a financial analyst who works for Anne in finance. Faye has a technical background. She spent 4 years in IT, he says, as he hands out papers to each of us. She created these SOX 404 control documents for the finance team. It shows the end-to-end information flow for the main business processes in each financially significant account. She documented where money or assets entered the system and traced it all the way to the general ledger. This is pretty standard, but she took it one step further.
She didn't look at any of the IT systems until she understood exactly where in the process material errors could occur and where they would be detected. She found that most of the time, we would detect it in a manual reconciliation step, where account balances and values from one source were compared to another, usually on a weekly basis. "When this happens," he says, with awe and wonder in his voice, "she knew the upstream IT systems should be out of scope of the audit." "Here's what she showed the auditors," John says, excitedly flipping to the second page. Quote, "The control being relied upon to detect material errors is the manual reconciliation step, not in the upstream IT systems. I went through all of Faye's papers, and in every case, the auditors agreed, withdrawing their IT finding. That's why Eric called the pile of audit findings a scoping error. He's right. If the audit test plan was scoped correctly in the beginning, there wouldn't have been any IT findings," he concludes. John looks around as Patty, Wes, and I stare blankly at him. I say, "I'm not following. How does this relate to reducing the audit workload?" "I'm rebuilding our compliance program from scratch, based upon our new understanding of precisely where we're relying our controls," John says. "That dictates what matters. It's like having a magic set of glasses that can differentiate what controls are earth-shatteringly important versus those that have no value at all." "Yes," I say. "Those magic glasses helped us finally see what matters to Dick for company operations. It was right in front of us for years, but we never saw it." John nods and smiles broadly. He flips to the last page of the handout. "I'm proposing 5 things that could reduce our security-related workload by 75%. What he presents is breathtaking. His first proposal drastically reduces the scope of the SOX 404 compliance program. When he verbalizes so precisely why it's safe to do, I realize that John, too, is also mastering the first way, having truly achieved a profound appreciation of the system. His second proposal requires that we find out how production vulnerabilities got there in the first place, and that we ensure that they don't happen again by modifying our deployment process. His third proposal requires that we flag all the systems in the scope for compliance audits in Patty's change management process, so we can avoid changes that could jeopardize our audits, and that we create the ongoing documentation that the auditors will ask for. John looks around, seeing all of us staring at him in shocked silence. "Did I say something wrong?"
"No offense, John," Wes says slowly. "But, you feeling okay?"
I say, "John, I don't think you'll get any objections from my team on your proposals. I think they're great ideas." Wes and Patty vehemently nod in agreement. Looking pleased, he continues, "My fourth proposal is to reduce the size of our PCI compliance program by getting rid of anything that stores or processes cardholder data, which is like toxic waste. Losing or mishandling it can be lethal, and it costs too much to protect. Let's start with the asinine cafeteria point-of-sale system. I never want to do another security review of that piece of crap. Frankly, I don't care who takes it, even if it's Sarah's cousin Vinny. It's gotta go." Patty has one hand covering her mouth, and even Wes's jaw is on the table. Has John completely lost his mind? This proposal seems potentially reckless. Wes thinks for a moment and changes his mind.
"I love it! I wish we could have gotten rid of it years ago. We've spent months securing that system for those audits. It even went into scope for the SOX 404 audits because it talked to the payroll systems."
Patty eventually nods. "I suppose no one would argue that the cafeteria POS is a core competency. It doesn't help our business, but can definitely hurt it. And it pulls scarce resources from Phoenix and our in-store POS systems, which are definitely part of our core competencies." "Okay, John, let's do it. You're batting 4 for 4, I say decisively. "But Do you really think we can get rid of it in time to make a difference?
Yep, John says, smiling confidently. I've already talked with Dick and the legal team. We just need to find a suitable outsourcer and convince ourselves that they can be trusted to maintain and secure the systems and data. We can outsource the work, but not the responsibility.
Wes interjects hopefully.
Can you do something about getting Phoenix out of scope of the audits too?
Over my dead body, John says flatly, crossing his arms. My fifth and last proposal is that we pay down all the technical debt in Phoenix, using all the time we've saved from my previous proposals. We know there's a huge amount of risk in Phoenix. Strategic risk, operational risk, huge security and compliance risk. Almost all of Dick's key measures hinge on it. As Patty said, our order entry and inventory management systems are a core competency. We're relying on it to give us a competitive edge. But with all the shortcuts we've taken with it, it's like a powder keg waiting to blow up.
Wes sighs, looking annoyed. Bad old John is back, his expression says. I disagree. This John is far more complex and nuanced than the old John. In the span of a couple of minutes, he's been willing to take bigger, almost reckless risks, from outsourcing our cafeteria POS systems to his unyielding and categorical insistence that we secure and harden Phoenix. I like this new John.
You're absolutely right, John. We've got to pay down technical debt, I say firmly. How do you propose we do it?
We quickly agree to pair up people in Wes's and Chris's group with John's team so that we can increase the bench of security expertise. By doing this, we will start integrating security into all of our daily work, no longer securing things after they're deployed. John thanks everyone, indicating that we've covered everything on his agenda. I look at my watch. We're done 30 minutes early. This must be a new world record for the shortest time required to agree on anything security-related.